Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, stream our show at nprnews.org/listen live every weekday at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, NPR's Steve Inskeep on his new biography of the Fremonts, how the politics of 1860 are surprisingly relevant to 2020, and yes, how Steve aces those interviews on just a few hours of sleep. Jessie Fremont would learn early in her marriage what it meant to be wedded to an ambitious, restless, and often impulsive young man. She was pregnant with their first child when John Fremont set off on a westward expedition to parts largely unmapped and unfamiliar. Mr. Fremont was gone into the silence and the unknown, the young bride said. How silent, how unknown, it is impossible to make clear. This would be the pattern of their lives, although, as Steve Inskeep reveals, Jessie began to first bring his expeditionary feats to eager audiences, then accompany her husband on some of his travels, and ultimately help position him for a political career. Along the way, Jessie Fremont would become such a celebrity that a song was written about her and sung to the tune of Yankee Doodle Dandy. Stephen Keith's new book is titled Imperfect Union, How Jessie and John Fremont Mapped the West, Invented Celebrity, and Helped Cause the Civil War. And Steve is with us today from NPR in Washington. Welcome, Steve. It's good to have you on the show.
Carrie, it's a delight to be here. Thanks for the introduction.
Let's join John Fremont in May of 1845. He's arrived in St. Louis. He's mobbed by men who want to go along on the expedition. What do average Americans at this point know about him, and why has he captured their imagination in such a way?
By 1845, John Charles Fremont was already one of the most famous men in America. He was totally unknown just 3 years earlier, but in the intervening time, he had made a couple of these expeditions to the American West, starting from St. Louis, which at that time was the westernmost city of the United States. He was going out over what was called the Louisiana Purchase and going beyond that to Oregon, which was disputed territory with Britain, and even to California, which was part of Mexico at that time. And he'd come back, and with Jessie, who you very appropriately highlighted, wrote these, I think we can call them best-selling accounts of his adventures. They were official army reports, but they would be excerpted in newspapers, and they would be turned into books for the public by multiple publishers. So people all over America were reading about this guy right at the moment of Manifest Destiny. 1845 is also the year that that term Manifest Destiny was coined to describe America's supposed destiny to overspread the continent with its millions.
You know, Steve, I was trying to get in the mindset of the age as I read the book and think what it must have been like to understand that so much of the country was new and unmapped and to want to be along, to maybe be, you know, the first among of a few people to set foot in some of these places. How many people were eager to be part of that kind of exploration?
There were thousands, but I want to emphasize that it was a relatively small number of people, and we can't say all of their motivations. Some of them were people who were seeking adventure. Some of them were seeking their fortune. Some of them were fleeing misfortune. We should note that the early 1840s was the tail end of a very, very long recession, really depression in the United States. There was a lot of economic desperation. And there was some number of people who, in some cases, after reading John C. Fremont's writings, went west for their various reasons. Mormons, among them, they read Fremont's accounts of the Great Salt Lake and decided to move from Illinois to what is now Utah in the Great Salt Lake area. So there were lots of different people for different reasons, but there was also this broader narrative that they could all plug into, whatever their personal motivations, personal fortune or adventure or achievement or anything else. There was this broader narrative of the westward spread of civilization and the westward spread of America. It is a little hard for us to talk about this now because I think we understand better how freighted that was with a sense of cultural superiority and racism and everything else. This was primarily white Americans who saw themselves as a kind of new race of white people called Americans who were going to go across the West and take it over and bring the light of reason and civilization everywhere. The reality was much more complicated in every way. In one way, of course, it was the native peoples that were being shoved aside and in many cases destroyed, or that land was being taken from Mexicans, who in turn had taken the land from Indians. There was a lot of complexity. But there's another part of this complexity too, Carrie, that I try to underline, and that is that the people who went west to make America were themselves far more diverse than we might imagine now. Even though John Charles Fremont was the vanguard of this white America that was overspreading the continent and this race of Americans that was viewed as primarily descendants of Britain, he had immigrants on his expeditions. He had a German immigrant mapmaker. He had French-speaking experts in the West who he hired in St. Louis, whose families had been there since French colonial times. He had African Americans. He hired Indians for his expeditions, which for me underlines the reality that there is this great country that was made in this problematic way that's hard even to talk about now, but it is a great country, and it's the legacy of a great many different kinds of people. It is no one kind of person that made America.
Okay, two things about what you've just said. I want to come back to in a minute about who was living in California and who John Fremont basically kind of shoves aside and thinks this won't be an impediment. But as you talk about these expeditions and who was joining them, I have to say I didn't know much about Kit Carson until I read your book. He's along on this expedition that we should note is going to go through the Rocky Mountains and into California. He's kind of an iconic figure in the American West. You give us a different view of him.
Yeah, this is a guy who was very famous in his time for some things that we would consider horrifying today. He was a young man who was orphaned. He was apprenticed to a saddle maker, I think, in Missouri and ran away while he was still a teenager and spent decades moving across the West, sometimes as a fur trapper, sometimes as a guide for people like John Charles Fremont, eventually as an American soldier. Along the way, he participated repeatedly in the massacres and murder of countless Indians. He could be a brutal and ruthless guy. He was expert at his job, however, and was famed in his time. He was a kind of folk hero. At some point, he also gave an oral history of his times. He was believed to be illiterate. He gave an oral history of some of his experiences, which made him more famous still. He's faded a little bit in American memory, I think for the same reason that the Fremonts have faded a little bit in American memory, because they participated in this chain of events that are vital to the creation of America, but that we kind of don't like to talk about because of the awkward or even worse than awkward realities involved in it.
So let's talk about one of the awkward realities, which you alluded to, which is there are Mexican settlers in California. There's Native Americans who have staked some claims. Fremont, I think you use the word dreamland. Fremont thinks of California as a dreamland. How does the idea of California kind of shimmer in the American imagination at this point?
This is one of my favorite things in the book, although I should stop and say almost everything in this book is something that I stumbled across and kind of fell in love with in one way or another. And that's not bragging about the book. It's the material, how fascinating it is. And one part of it is that you have these people who arrive very early in American history, Americans very early in American history, who arrive in Mexican-controlled California. And we should note there are a few thousand Mexican colonists or settlers, and there are several hundred thousand native peoples who've been there for centuries. But the Mexicans have set up this string of missions up the coast. They later closed the missions but kept towns and settlements and ranches or ranchos. There's a kind of Mexican civilization, and there are numerous numerous Indian nations there. And then a few American settlers begin arriving there and fit in one way or another and are able to get huge amounts of land. And then John Charles Fremont, almost by accident, while seeking supplies, goes over the Sierra Nevada mountains in the middle of winter, slashing through the snow with an expedition of his that had been lost, and arrives in California's Central Valley and finds it to be this magical place. He falls in love with it the way that generations of Americans have fallen in love with California. It's a strange, for someone from the East, as I am, when you go to California, it's an almost otherworldly landscape. These yellow hills and the Central Valley and the giant forests and the shockingly high mountains and singular mountains like Mount Shasta, this volcano that rises up and is covered with snow. And that's before you even get to San Francisco Bay and look at the coastline. Everything is magical about it. And John C. Fremont said in a memoir that after that first brief accidental visit to California, he had resolved to make this his home, and that he seemed to understand that it was a place not just to live, but a place to pursue his ambitions, because it was going to be in some way the center of the world. He's a guy who seems to have understood, thanks to his father-in-law, a kind of visionary and powerful senator, seems to have understood very well that California could be the center of the global economy, that it could be America's entry point to trade with Asia, which has become the very center of all the world economy. Yeah. He knew that California could be that, and he knew it in the 1840s when he first saw it.
He has, and maybe this brings us back to what you were saying about manifest destiny, but he has few qualms about this idea of pushing people off the land and, you know, pulling people up from their stakes. And does it come back to this philosophy of, no, we are the people who are meant to be here, and now we've arrived with civilization?
Yeah, I think that Fremont did think that he was a leading light of civilization. I should make a distinction that doesn't really defend John C. Fremont, but it is a distinction. Mm-hmm. He wasn't someone like Kit Carson, who went on to participate in one brutal Indian war after another and just massacred unbelievable numbers of people. John C. Fremont was someone who seemed to know better, who understood that Indians were being mistreated by U.S. government policy throughout his lifetime, who explicitly wrote that the United States repeatedly in treaties made promises to Indians and broke all the treaties and only kept the promise to take their land. He understood how wrong it was and saw himself as someone who could befriend Indians and employ them and somehow civilize them in certain cases. And yet he still participated in this act and still participated in several massacres of Indians in which Kit Carson was also present. And he would make friends with native people who often saved his life on his expeditions. And then he would go back east and write these accounts where he would write about them as savages in this racist and patronizing way.
Yeah. That part of it really seems shameless. It made me wonder about the kind of what you uncovered about the characteristics of, you know, the internal kind of the personal characteristics of Fremont, how we square some of the acts that seemed very generous and open and receptive, and some of the acts that seemed mean and petty and racist.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's human, I think, is the simple way to put it. And some people have read this book and just not really like John C. Fremont at all, which I think is perfectly justified. Huh. I'm just going to call him an interesting character rather than a likable character. Some people have liked his wife, Jessie, better, although Jessie was a participant in many of the things that he did, or a promoter of many of the things that he did. They are complicated individuals. And I'm not going to excuse them by saying they were products of their time, because there were people in their time who knew better, and there is even some evidence the Fremonts knew better. They were complicated individuals who ultimately stood on the right side of history. After this exploration of the West, John C. Fremont became the first nominee of the Republican Party for president, and that's at a time when it was an anti-slavery party. He was on the right side of history, ultimately, and a case can be made that the Fremonts together made America a little more equal than it might have been otherwise, or participated in great events that made America more equal than it would have been otherwise. And yet there is this darkness to their story. And one thing I would like us to consider when we think about that darkness is to just ask ourselves, are we doing better? Mm. Mm-hmm. You know, and as a nation, I think we are much better and much fairer and much more equal than we were then. And yet there may well be things we are doing today that history will regard as awful as some of the things that were done in the 1840s and 50s.
Morning Edition host Steve Inskeep is on the air with us this morning. We're talking about his new book, Imperfect Union, how Jesse and John Fremont mapped the West, invented celebrity, and helped cause the Civil War. So if you've been listening as our conversation develops, you hear us talking about the way John Charles Fremont was pushing west on these expeditions, and we haven't talked much about Jesse Fremont, and I want to do that with Steve as well. I'm going to ask him also to read an excerpt that I also think is revealing about some of the characteristics that make him a bold and brave explorer, but also a man known to take some impulsive risks. So you'll hear that from Steve. And I invite you into the conversation. Curiosity about these times in American history, curiosity about how John C. Fremont sustained these expeditions and what his wife was doing. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. Curiosity about Steve Inskeep himself on Twitter, at Carrie NPR. Steve, Jeremy writes, you talked about white Americans and Mexicans and assaults on Native peoples. Why don't we refer to those periods as times of genocide?
I think you can. It's just a matter of definition. I think that the specific acts that John Charles Fremont was involved in would probably be counted as something less. But that is not in any way to defend them. This is a guy who traveled among Indians most of the time, carrying the lamps of science and reason. He would have these navigational instruments that would allow him to chart his course by the stars. He was a map maker. He was making maps of the West as he went. And he was a writer, and he was a reader who would travel with works of literature and read them in the most horrible conditions in the snow. So he was that. And yet when he got to California in 1845, 1846, he fell in with a number of white settlers who had some kind of a problem with local Indians, with Native nations, and decided to launch a preventive war against them. And his men went into a number of villages and killed everybody they could find. Mm. And there are multiple accounts of this. There's no doubt that it happened. I suppose it is fair to say that he was a participant in the broader genocide of the time, the broader loss of untold millions of people over the course of centuries.
Would you read just these couple paragraphs that I asked that I think are kind of revealing about him?
Oh, yeah, I love this, and I'm delighted that
you
picked them out. This is John Charles Fremont. He has arrived in California. It's still Mexican-controlled California. It's 1846. He's not supposed to be there. He's a United States Army officer traveling with a bunch of civilians. He is basically an illegal immigrant. He's come without a passport. He's gone and said hello to the Mexican authorities and said he's just passing through, and that as soon as he has resupplied his men, he's going to go on to northward to Oregon, so not to worry about him. And he would stay away from settled areas. But then he couldn't help himself and didn't stay away from settled areas and rode with his men down to the coast not far from Monterey, which was then the capital and is still a lovely city. So he's down in this lovely part of California because he's drawn to the landscape, and he's acting like he already owns it. He's naming places. He named the Golden Gate, by the way. He's giving names to things as he goes. And he writes what his motivation was for going toward these settled areas and risking confrontation, risking a war with Mexican authorities. And this is a quote from his own memoir. "I had before my mind the home I wish to make in this country. First one place and then another charmed me, but none seemed perfect where the sea was wanting. And so far I had not stood by the open waves of the Pacific. Only the coastline had the invigorating salt breeze which brings with it renewed strength. This I wanted for my mother." John C. Fremont had loved the sea since he was a boy. His happiest moments had been spent in places where the eye ranges over a broad expanse of country or in the face of the ocean, walking the Battery in Charleston, South Carolina alone, or exploring the shore with a young woman that he loved. Now he sought to recover that feeling on the western coast, and he'd heard that Santa Cruz was especially beautiful. So John Charles Fremont risked war between the United States and Mexico because he wanted to shop for beachfront property to share with his mom.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. I mean, I think you say he's feeling increasingly entitled about this land. And
yes.
He thinks, I got to have some of this for myself and my mom.
Yes, and that was the real effect of the ideology of manifest destiny. That term had actually been coined after Fremont went out on this expedition. He wouldn't have known it, but he knew the idea had been around for decades. Americans would show up in Mexican-controlled California, which the Mexicans themselves had taken from Indians, and immediately upon showing up, thought of it as their own place. And as soon as the Mexican authorities began complaining about anything that they were doing, they were very angry at the Mexican authorities who were impinging on their rights. That's what an ideology can do for you.
Yeah. A couple calls here from John in South Minneapolis. Hi, John. Thanks for waiting.
Hi.
What do you want to know?
Well, I've been listening halfway through Mr. Inskeep's book about Fremont, and this morning he kind of mentions Kit Carson, who traveled with Fremont,
right,
as being kind of a savage. And I was wondering if he's read Blood and Thunder, which is about Kit Carson. And then in that book, they say that at the end of his life, Kit Carson started to realize that what they were doing to the Indian was wrong and took the other side of the issue. Huh. Also, during his life, during the Indian Wars, he was acting more or less as a Native American would, taking revenge, killing each other. That was the way the natives lived, according to the book.
Okay,
and
so
I just wondered what his thoughts on that are.
Yeah, so Steve, more nuanced view of Kit Carson.
Thanks. That book, Blood and Thunder by Hampton Sides, is an excellent book, and I recommend it to you. And yes, I have read it. He's a very good writer. I've read a bunch of his books. It is true that there were people like Kit Carson who regretted what they had done a little later in life, and it's clear to me that John C. Fremont regretted some of the things that he had done a little bit later in life. But I just want to note, I don't want to totally excuse people in that circumstance. I mean, they did what they did, and there are a lot of occasions in the 19th century, and again, this may be true of us sometimes today, a lot of occasions in the 19th century where people say, oh, it's very regrettable, even as they were doing these regrettable things. That's absolutely true of slavery, for example. There were a lot of people who participated in slavery who even owned slaves while saying, you know, this is evil. This is a terrible system. It's too bad that we inherited this system and have to participate in it. I guess you can give them a little bit of credit for perceiving that, but you almost want to judge them more harshly because they went right ahead and did it.
Call here from Rob in Moorhead. Hey, Rob, hi.
Hey, good morning. Hey, I'm kind of an amateur historian on Joseph Nicolet. And he did an expedition, Nicolet Mall, obviously, in the Twin Cities named after him. But he came up the
Yes, he discovered
Western
the Nicolet
edge.
Mall. Isn't that right? No, that's a joke. Yeah. That's a joke. Please, go on.
Right. But he came up the western edge of the Red River Valley on an expedition. And I've read through that diary. And I know Fremont was on that. And I know Nicolet had pretty good relations with the Native Americans. I was just wondering what kind of maybe influence Nicolet had on Fremont.
Thanks for raising that. Yeah, Nicolet is obviously imprinted on the landscape and even the mallscape of this region. And he was a mentor to John C. Fremont. And one way that immigrants are a huge part of this story and a huge part of the building of America. John C. Fremont, by the way, was the illegitimate son of a French immigrant. Nicolet was a French immigrant who was a scientist in France, who apparently got the idea that his understanding of numbers and science could allow him to beat the stock market, and he went bankrupt, had to leave France because he was broke, and came to America to start a new life, and ended up being an explorer, essentially working on this great challenge of how to measure the earth, how to map and understand the earth when you could only ever see one little bit of it at a time. There were no satellites. There were no satellite photos. There was no overhead anything, really. How would you map things in that circumstance? And Nicolet had learned from other Europeans the best techniques of celestial navigation, of figuring out altitude and distance between different points, and went across the prairies of the Midwest making measurements and drawing in little notebooks and leaving beautiful descriptions in French, which I have read. You can go. I've had people translate for me. I'm not a French reader, but you can go get these notebooks. Look at the actual notebooks in the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C. And on a couple of his expeditions, his apprentice was a U.S. Army lieutenant, John Charles Fremont, who wasn't really formally educated in that kind of science, but learned it more or less as an apprentice under Joseph Nicolet, this immigrant.
So while her husband is off naming things and claiming land that isn't his, Jesse Fremont is in Washington with their daughter, and she begins to see this new role for herself. And you say this about that. Although she was young and a woman whose assigned sphere didn't include politics, she was an accomplished lady with an emerging public profile. How was she putting that profile to work on behalf of John Fremont?
Yeah, I should mention, I think accomplished lady is in quotes, right? That's a quote from a newspaper article.
Yes, it is. Yes.
She was an influential Washington wife. There in the 19th century were a lot of influential Washington wives. My late dear colleague Cokie Roberts wrote about this in a number of books that are very easily available today. Lots of Washington women were influential very quietly behind the scenes. Jessie was influential that way, but also built up a public profile. She was a kind of proto-publicist. You asked how she helped to build up the image of her husband. She would help to write these reports that made him famous. She was sometimes a secretary. She would take dictation. He was in no shape to write himself, it was said, and so he would pace the room while telling the story of what he had done, and she would be writing it down, and he might be watching in her face to see her response to his words and maybe change some words. So she would be that. She would be an editor. She might be, in some cases, a writing partner, in a few cases even a ghostwriter. She was also his political representative when he was away from Washington, and she was based in Washington. She would be his publicist. He would manage to write a letter from California, and it would take months and months through some circuitous route to get to Washington, D.C., and she would see that this letter that he had written was basically a press release describing everything that he had just done, and she would arrange for it to get published in the newspaper, and it would quickly be published in other newspapers and spread across the country. She was, I don't want to entirely say the brains of the operation. Mm-hmm. He was a smart guy, and he was ambitious all his own, but she added a lot to what he could do and was very much his partner even when he was absent.
So this is what I wondered about. I mean, it's clear from some of the letters that she's writing to him that she misses him and that she loves him. But in some ways, I got the sense that he sees this as an advantageous marriage, and he doesn't deny what she brings to the operation, as you've just said, but that he doesn't love her as deeply as she loves him, and that maybe part of his heart remains with his first love, Cecilia. What did you come to understand about that?
Well, my mom agrees with you.
Really?
My mom was kind enough to read this book, and she said, I think Jesse loved him. I don't know if he loved her or loved her the same way. I suppose he loved her and would have said that he loved her, but he didn't express it nearly so well or nearly so often, particularly later in life. I think this is a guy who was more absorbed with his work in the West and more absorbed with being by himself in some vast landscape and in charge of the small group of men that he was with and absorbed with challenging himself against nature. When he was a boy in Charleston, South Carolina, he did a recitation. He recited this old speech by an American politician who talked about the way that the character of the free men of this new America would be molded by facing the challenges of the great landscape of the West. And that seemed to be what motivated John C. Fremont. That's what he was about. And rather than at some point being satisfied, he wasn't satisfied. I mean, there are many people. I was going to say young men. This must happen to young women, too. It's just stereotypically young men or traditionally young men who want to go out and test themselves, who want to go out to sea or go to war or go to the West or do something really hard and see if they can measure up. And then you find out you can measure up and you can go on and settle down and have a family and do other things. John C. Fremont did have a family, but didn't get to that point where he'd ever had enough. He kept needing to move, to go out west again and again, even when it meant that he would be away from his wife and children for months and months at a time. And I think in addition to that urge, he was, after a while, a sort of damaged person. He went through these extreme experiences in the wilderness that were very much like going to war. And in fact, in one case, it became a war at the end of the extreme experiences. And it's tempting to diagnose him almost with some kind of PTSD. Oh, I don't want to say that posthumously of someone that we can't diagnose, but I just mean to suggest that he seemed troubled. He seemed unsettled. He seemed increasingly lost within his own mind rather than at some point being satisfied that he had accomplished a lot and could settle down.
Yeah, that really gives me a different dimension on that. Steve Inskeep is with us this morning for the hour, and we're talking about Imperfect Union, how Jesse and John Fremont mapped the West, invented celebrity, and helped cause the Civil War. Okay, we've talked about the mapping of the West. We've talked a bit about the invention of celebrity. I want to talk to Steve about how the new technology of the day ends up being a very powerful tool for shaping Fremont's persona. And we'll talk about, I think you heard Steve allude to the fact that Fremont was the Republican nominee for president. We'll talk about how slavery and religion really roiled that election season. 651-227-6000 for questions about who accompanied Fremont on these expeditions, what the history of the time reveals, maybe some relevance to today. To the phones here to Les in Duluth.
Thank you. This probably changes the subject a little bit, but, you know, Steve Inskeep, as well as you, Carrie, are very much respected and revered purveyors of news and opinions. And I'm just wondering what Steve's motivation or his inspiration was to do the research and literally, I guess, pick up a pen and go into a subject like this is when he's got so many other irons in the fire.
Thank you for your kind comments. I really appreciate it. The work that you like, that you hear on the radio, is in many ways the inspiration for the books that I write, because I cover the news on NPR and various other places from time to time. And it makes me really interested in the backstory of events. I try to have a sense of history in the way that I bring you the news every day and think about what is really important and what is important over the long term and what are the things we really need to know as opposed to desperate, urgent breaking news that we'll barely remember 2 hours from now, you know? And that makes me want to go back into history. And I've done this a few times now. And when I tell a story like Imperfect Union, I am learning about 1840s and 1850s Washington, D.C., where I live. And I'm learning about California, where I've covered stories, and learning about a lot of places in between where I have been, Savannah, Georgia, Charleston, South Carolina, St. Louis, Missouri, on Kentucky, on and on, learning all these facts. And I get to follow an earlier version of the news we're covering now. A lot of the debates then, like now, were about race or immigration or national identity. Who counts as American and what rights do they have? What does America stand for? People were arguing about that then, and they were having the same arguments in the same places and in some cases the same buildings. You know, I get from time to time, I was just there the other day doing an interview, I get from time to time to go to the United States Capitol here in Washington. And the building has been expanded and changed, but it's fundamentally the same building that Jesse Benton Fremont's father, Thomas Hart Benton, a U.S. senator, went to work in the early part of the 19th century, and where John C. Fremont was himself briefly a United States senator. They've added on to it, but some of the hallways, some of the chambers are the same.
Steve, you're kind of alluding to something that I was curious about, which is, immersed as you must be in the day-to-day urgency and drama of the news, did you find that in also being immersed in the letters and the diaries and the mapping and the research that you were doing for this book gave you a distance, a little bit of a distance, that ends up being pretty valuable day-to-day?
Oh, I totally agree with that. You're exactly right. It affects what I think is an important breaking news story, for example. I sometimes feel like 90% of urgent breaking news is stuff you don't need to know because it's not, it doesn't matter over the long term. It might not even matter tomorrow, as compelling as it seems now. And when I see some urgent development on Twitter or hear about it or we're considering what to put on the air, that crosses my mind. Just to take a moment and reflect on this and think about it. And if you have that perspective, even giving yourself an extra minute may influence what we put on the air, what we don't trouble you with.
All right. Call here from Luke in Minneapolis. Hi, Luke.
Hi. Thanks a lot for taking my call. Another wonderful conversation you're leading.
Thank you.
Talking here locally. The question I have, we lived in Canada for a few years, and one of the things I was amazed about is that the diversity up there, as well as the acceptance of different cultures. And I had asked them, I said, you know, what's the difference between the U.S. and Canada? And he had said, you know what, the difference, in my opinion, was slavery, in terms of how big of a black eye that is on the United States and how it really hasn't been dealt with. So the question I have for you, Steve, it sounds like a wonderful book. Your insight and knowledge on history is amazing. So what implications, what next steps do you recommend using this type of data, this type of insight, to really lean forward in terms of the awareness as well as, you know, next best steps, considering that we're in election season here? For a politician, this type of insight, how do you use it to mend fences as well as to create programs that really authentically make some change for the future?
Thank you. I appreciate the question. I think a good first step is simply to tell the truth. To tell the truth about our past as well as our present, and not to be afraid of that. There was a time earlier in this country when I think a lot more people believed that we needed to have an idealized version of America's past, or the young people who were being taught American history wouldn't believe in the country. I don't think that that is true. You may have a parent or grandparent whose history is complicated, who did a lot of things in their life that you disagree with, but you still love that person. And I think love of country is the same way. One of the ways to show your love for a person or for your country is to tell the truth and to be frank about what is there. It is also a good way to heal. You talked about bringing people together. Think about that in terms of therapy or in terms of dealing with your own past. Telling the truth, being honest about it, is the way that you then face what the problems are. So being truthful about the past is, for me, very much about the present. And it doesn't discourage me about the country. There's a reality that you realize when you look at the 1840s and 50s, as I did, or at other American historical periods. And it's a reality that politicians know, that is often said this way: in a democracy, in politics, nothing is ever over. You have the same arguments over and over and over and over again. We will forever, have forever, and will forever argue about race and national identity and immigration and who counts as American and what the borders should be and how the borders should be defended and so many other things that we're arguing about right now. That can be a depressing thought. This never ends. But it can also be an encouraging thought, because if you realize the argument goes on and on, you also realize that we gradually get better at that argument over time. For all the problems we have now, it was worse then. For all the repetition of the arguments from an earlier age, I think our answers to those questions are better over time, and it's hard to deny that. For all the inequality and awfulness of this moment, it's hard to deny that it is a more equal and less awful and more inspiring country than it was. That for whatever our image may be in the world, however we feel about America right now, and people both on the right and the left feel bad in different ways about the way that America has gone, this is a country that has thrashed about, made so many mistakes, and yet somehow moved gradually in the right direction. And the fact that nothing is ever over becomes something in our favor. We're going to keep having that argument and hopefully keep getting a little better at answering the questions that we face.
You know, Steve, you're reminding me of the show that we did a week ago Thursday about patriotism. And this is what we call this flyover, you know, digging into ideas about identity and how geography influences that and family legacy. What I heard in that conversation, which I thought was just terrific, we had people that were really wrestling with who gets to call themselves a patriot. You know, you can hear views advancing and probably quite different than what it would have sounded like if I'd done that show right after 9/11. And some of what you wrote in this book influenced the way I was thinking about framing that conversation. These people would have thought of themselves as the best kind of patriots, right? They were doing, wouldn't John Fremont have said, I'm doing this for the supremacy of this country and this is what we were meant to do. That's my definition of patriotism.
Yes. Yes, of course he was ambitious for himself and wanted to advance in the world, but he wanted to be a better American. He wanted to test himself against the landscape, right, and he wanted to build up the nation. And his wife, Jessie Fremont, wrote in memoirs later in life in very similar ways about her experiences, not only the work that she did for John, but the suffering that she endured with her beloved husband away for months or years at a time. She accepted that, she said, as her lot, as part of the price she was paying for a better country.
So let's, I don't want to miss talking about his run for president. He is the Republican nominee in the 1856 election against John Buchanan and Millard Fillmore. And this election ends up being roiled by debates about slavery and religion. The Fremonts are on the right side of history on those debates, yes?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that they had views that we would endorse today. The Republican Party was a brand new party, the first major national party that was seriously against slavery. And yet the Republicans even did not call for abolition of slavery. That was considered an extreme position, even an unconstitutional position, because the Constitution protected slavery without explicitly mentioning it. But they did call for an end to the expansion of slavery. They called for the containment of slavery. And many people who called for that had an idea that eventually slavery would go away. And the Fremonts were the first. I said the Fremonts were the first nominee. I was talking of them as a pair, which is kind of appropriate because Jesse was becoming so prominent. It was almost like she was part of the campaign. You alluded to this earlier. There were songs about her as well as about him. But John C. Fremont was the first nominee of this party that was trying something new in American politics. Always before, any national party to have a serious chance at winning the presidency needed votes from the North and votes from the South, votes from free states and votes from slave states, which called upon them at least to be silent about slavery, if not actively supported in different ways. The Republicans realized there'd been a demographic change in America. The North was getting far more populous than the South. It was becoming possible to elect a president with Northern votes alone, and that is what they tried. That is why it was possible to have an anti-slavery party. It turned out that demographic change was very destabilizing. The South was extremely threatened and made noises about leaving the Union to protect their rights, by which I mean the white South protecting their right to slavery, among other things, everything that went along with it. This was destabilizing then, just as demographic changes to America are destabilizing now. We're in the midst of a big demographic change that seems to favor one political party. The growing groups, people of color, immigrants, and so forth, have voted in recent years more Democratic than otherwise, and that gives Democrats a kind of confidence that eventually they will inherit the country without compromising with Republicans or conservatives, and makes conservatives feel very threatened. That's the backdrop for the last several years of our politics here. It's something that President Trump explicitly referred to in his campaign in 2016 when he told supporters, this is your last chance to take control of the country before it's flooded with illegal immigrants. These are things that he literally said again and again and said on video. There's no doubt about it what he meant with those remarks. That is the backdrop of the 2016 election and of a lot of things that have happened since. And you now have Democrats who feel threatened that they'll be shut out of power forever in different ways, and that makes things even more destabilizing.
I also don't want to miss the role, how religion ends up leading to, I think what you say is the bravest, arguably the bravest decision of Fremont's life. And again, how relevant what was happening in this election of 1856 sounds to some of the discussions we're having today about the influence of faith.
Yeah, there was a huge anti-immigrant movement that was extremely powerful in the 1850s. This nativist movement, people called themselves Native Americans, by which they did not mean Indians. They meant they were native-born white people, the sons and grandsons or whatever of immigrants, but they were against immigration. And you mentioned religion. That was a big part of it. People were opposed to a particular kind of immigrant, people who practiced this alien and threatening religion, Catholicism, which was considered somehow incompatible with America and incompatible with democracy and something that would bring foreign influence, the Pope or the Austrian Empire or somebody, depending on the conspiracy theory, would be using Catholic immigrants to somehow control the United States. And nativists would say, I vow to make sure that no foreigner ever holds a position of power in this country. And they would have proposals that would make it harder and harder for immigrants to vote, for example. That was happening then. And John C. Fremont, when he ran for president in 1856, faced a series of accusations. First, it was revealed that he was the illegitimate son of an immigrant. Then the story was changed to suggest that he was an immigrant, born outside the U.S. and ineligible for the presidency. And then the birthers of 1856 went on to suggest that he was not only an immigrant, but also Catholic, which was not true. But yeah, Fremont made a brave decision. It was also a tactical decision. He and the other people in the campaign were trying to do the smartest thing. But when faced with this accusation that he was a Catholic, he refused to deny it. He refused to deny it because if he said, wait a minute, I'm Protestant, he would also be saying, there is no freedom of religion in America and a Catholic shouldn't be president. And having known and worked closely with Catholics such as Joseph Nicolet, his mentor, he didn't want to do that.
He loses the election, as I think everybody knows who knows their presidential history. Does he see the end of his political life, and do you feel like he had some peace of mind, you know, towards the end of his life?
He did sort of see the end of his political life. When approached about running again 4 years later, he declined. But peace of mind, no. He remained a restless soul. He had a long life yet ahead of him. He ended up being involved in the Civil War. Abraham Lincoln was the person who got the presidency with Northern votes alone, the very path that John C. Fremont had pioneered. Abraham Lincoln won in 1860. Civil War did come as the South seceded, and Fremont became a general in that war, a very controversial general who feuded with Lincoln and then did test the political waters again and actually ran against Lincoln for a short time in 1864 when Lincoln was facing re-election. Later, he tried to go into business. He'd made a fortune in the gold rush in California, which he then blew again in railroad investments, and had a struggling and difficult later life. I don't think peace of mind is anything that we would associate with him, and I will even say this, which maybe is one of the things that disappointed my mom about John C. Fremont. Mm-hmm. He spent so much time going west, leaving his wife and his family behind. And finally, at the end of their lives in 1887, Jesse decided that for his health, he should have the climate of California, and they moved from the East Coast to the West Coast. They moved to Los Angeles. They were also broke by then, and there seemed to be some possibility to make some money in Los Angeles. And they were there for a little while together, and then John C. Fremont decided that he needed to go back east.
Oh, yes.
And he went away from her back to the east on a couple of long trips, trying to get various business ventures going or get a pension for his service in the war and so forth. He had things to do, but he went away from her and ultimately died a continent away from her in a boarding house in New York City in 1890.
Steve, we're going to close with a song that I think you like, and you've talked about its storytelling qualities. And I want to thank you so much for the hour. It's been great to have you.
I've really enjoyed it. Thank you for the questions.
Well, outside the law, you look and run out fast, and a few years came and went. Till he's trapped in an alley in Abilene with all before she'll spin. And he realized pain was the only thing that he had never tried. Well, he wasn't sure he knew quite how, but he looked up to the sky. Said you don't owe me nothing, and as far as I know, Lord, don't owe nothing to you. Well, I ain't asking for a miracle, Lord, just a little bit of luck to do.
Steve Earle with the song Tom Ames' Prayer from the album A Train Is A-Comin'. And Steve Inskeep's book is called Imperfect Union.
Yeah, but right now, Lord, I'm back to the wall. Can't help but recall how they nearly hung me for stealing a horse at Fort Smith, Arkansas. Parker said guilty and the gavel came next like a cannon shot. And I went away quietly and I began to file my plot. Well, I sent the preacher down to my cell. He said, Lord is your only hope. He's the only friend that you're gonna have when you hit the inner Parker's rope. And I guess he could have kept on preaching at Christmas, but he turned his back on me. I put a homemade blade to that golden throat, and that's the deputy for the key.
programming is supported by Great River Energy, providing reliable electric service to 28 Minnesota member co-ops with a diverse mix of power generation, including power plants and renewable energy. Great River Energy, powering what's possible.
It ain't the first close call I ever had, and I'm sure you already know. I had some help from you, loud. The devil himself's been strictly touch and go. Yeah, but who in the hell am I talking to? Ain't no one here but me. And then the cop pulled his pistols and the spit in the dirt, and he walked out in the street.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. If you'd like to hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast. And thanks for listening.